So hello and welcome back to the Now Age podcast with me, Ruby Warrington. This episode, if you're listening to it when it's just come out, is being published on July 4th, 2019. And it's a very fitting date considering my guest today, entirely coincidental, but as I have found so often in my life, particularly since starting work on the numinous and really trusting in the larger cycles as they play out, things really do begin to line up, which is to say my guests today are Janet McGillivray and Erin Wise of Seeding Sovereignty. Seeding Sovereignty is an organization which is seeking to amplify the voices and the lives of Indigenous American youth mainly, but the wider mission of the organization is, and I'm going to read this from their website so I get it right, Seeding Sovereignty are Indigenous folks growing radical change. In a time of climate crisis, Seeding Sovereignty, an Indigenous women-led collective, works on behalf of our global community to shift social and environmental paradigms by dismantling colonial institutions and replacing them with Indigenous practices created in synchronicity with the land. So it's an incredible mission, and I'm so thrilled to be offering the space to these two women today to share more about their mission, the work they're doing in the world, and how we can help support them in this. Janet, Erin, welcome.
And Janet, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And Janet, I think, Erin, you were mentioning you'd like to give an acknowledgement of where we're recording today also.
Yes, I just want to say thank you to the folks of traditional Lenape territory. We are in Lenape Hoking, which is known as New York City these days. And I just want to say thank you to the traditional peoples of the land for having us on your territories as guests from the Muskoki Nation and the Hickory Apache Nation and the Laguna Pueblo people.
Thank you so much, Erin. I would love if you could both just sort of give a little introduction about yourselves and what your roles are at Seeding Sovereignty. Janet.
Sure. Thank you so much, Ruby. We're very happy to be here. I am an environmental attorney who's focused on the impacts of environmental pollution on vulnerable communities, and I have had a series of wonderful work experiences over the course of some years, and it's led me to frontline community groups and understanding that leadership on issues of climate stewardship and how our communities can best heal is really driven by the people themselves. And so my work in developing a container for a new form of environmentalism is really acknowledging both the violence to the land and the violence to women and people and how that's intertwined, and to really raise up the voices of those that have not been given the platforms previously, and to examine new and actually old ways of stewardship and empowerment that are sorely lacking in this time.
Thank you, Janet. And Erin.
I was just thinking, wow, Janet's so cool.
Janet is very cool, you're right, yeah.
Yeah. I am currently the Communications and Digital Director for Seeding Sovereignty. That's my official title, but I'm more or less just a sister that is working with my sisters to try and do good works for not only our, you know, other siblings and our other relations, but specifically our Indigenous youth, our queer, trans, other identified Indigenous youth who are out there and really trying to reclaim their narrative. We are often seen as antiquated fixtures in the past, and a lot of our youth are dealing with severe issues in relations to the erasure that the United States has been committed to of Indigenous peoples here. And I am here primarily to give purpose to these youth and to share our platform in the best way that we can to ensure that the future generations that are coming in are healing and that they're inheriting a planet that is worth taking on. I don't want to give them something and them not be able to know what to deal with it or know how to and not have the tools. And so we're here to provide the tools as best we can.
Thank you so much. Yes. So for anybody listening, you're probably getting a clearer and better understanding of why it's so auspicious that we're having this or we're airing this conversation on July 4th. Indigenous Peoples Day, as it is known now. And I would love, I'm just going to share a little bit about how I came to be connected with you. And it's also a very auspicious time for me as I'm considering, you know, what is the next evolution for the Numinous and where do I take this platform going forward? I launched the Numinous around 7 years ago, primarily as a way to make emotional spiritual healing tools and modalities available to a much wider range of people than may have previously had access, many of these having their roots in different indigenous cultures and traditions around the world. And I sort of feel like that mission has been accomplished in many ways, and in some ways it's playing out in less than helpful ways now. And I'm really very cognizant of wanting to move forward with the Numinous and with this platform and with the conversation that we are here co-creating in a way that is really truly of service. So I thank you ladies both for being here to have this conversation with me today. I think it's a really important point in time, particularly as we move again, and I can't believe it's 4 years on, but into the presidential race again here in the US next year, like to really be thinking about what are we making a stand for? How are our lives and our actions and our own healing journeys actually helping to contribute what is truly needed at this time? So I, as many of you know, also in 2016, and it was funny actually thinking about that old election, it was the same month or maybe even within weeks of the current president being elected, that Alexandra Roxo and I launched Moon Club, which was designed to be a very inclusive space for women's healing. And at the time we had thought, well, one thing we would love to do is organize for our membership base some kind of a service trip abroad, like to actually kind of go help communities where we can on the ground. And in these conversations, I said to Alexandra, and we spoke about it most recently, what about here in the US? Like, this is where the healing really needs to be. And both of us descended from white colonizers on this land. Like, this is the work, here is the place. And we would like, and that's when we started looking for, well, who could we potentially partner with or learn from about how we can best serve here? And so we were introduced to you guys in Seeding Sovereignty by a mutual friend, Lane, who's been doing some pro bono work with you. And the conversation has developed from there. And Janet, you and I met a couple of months ago, I guess, and you shared with me the origin story of Seeding Sovereignty. And I'd love if we could begin today with hearing that from you, how you came to this work specifically and why it really feels like such a calling for you, and why now?
Thank you. And I was just thinking about how both of you are also quite cool. I'm very thrilled to be here listening to you both. Yes, I had a very unusual invitation and a wonderful and timely invitation that came my way a few years back to go down to the Lock and Don jungle and to be at a reunification ceremony of the Kogi and the Lock and Don, joined by the Guatemalans and the Aztec communities. And it was an invitation that reached me via someone who was trying to answer a question of the Kogi. They were looking for a woman in the north who had some indigenous ancestry, who had a large network, and who would be willing to come down and actually, in terms of the prophecy of the condor and the eagle, come from the north down to the south and actually join and to meet with them. It was an incredible opportunity. I actually decided almost instantaneously to not go to Paris for yet another conference of the parties on climate and to take an adventure and accept an invitation to go down into a jungle and where I was in the company of true teachers. I was over several days. It was an incredible series of very visceral experiences and great humble learning by myself. And essentially, at the end of the 4 days, which were coincidentally the same exact days of the 4 day fire in Paris, they had no sense of what was happening internationally. Mm-hmm. This was a very remote area with no Wi-Fi, no news, and yet on the same 4 days, they were having their own 4 day fire. And I stayed up in the evenings, and I would feed the fire, and I would sleep outside, and I ended up really feeling that this was, for me, the best way I could be spending my time, even though there was no language in common. It was all through body language. It was by listening through other means. It was deeply intuitive, and I felt such a generosity of their spirit and a great gratitude that I was invited. At the end of the 4 days, I was told that they were had a message for me from the mother, and the mother is their oracle, and it is the water. And the mother had offered me a seed, and they said, but you have to really think, will you accept the seed? This is a decision, it's a commitment, and it is something to be considered and deliberated on. And I went to sleep that night, and I immediately knew with every cell in my body that the answer was yes. I didn't know what I would do with this seed, but they told me the next day that the reason she had offered me a seed was because she knew that, quote, I would not put it on a shelf. Mm. I still didn't know what that would take the form of, but very shortly after that, I was invited by Chief Orville Looking Horse to come to Standing Rock. It started a series of events that forever changed my work direction, and I realized in those moments that the seed would be seeding sovereignty, and it really has to do with not reacting to things that are happening, but how do we move ahead? How do we move into a way of looking at what the upcoming generations are calling for? How do I take the skills and the networks that I have and actually offer that in some sort of service to people that I think I can build with in ways that are so much more productive and sustainable? And so that became the organization, and slowly, like a seed, it has grown. And I'm so thankful that Erin is part of our work.
And was this all in 2016?
It was.
Yeah. And how did you receive the invitation? How did it come to you? I'm curious. Like how did they find you?
Yeah. Smoke signals.
Yeah. Right.
It came through about three different people who just said we are looking for this particular set of characters, and I got a phone call, and the phone call to me was like a beacon, and I thought, this is exactly where I need to go. And it actually was the start of me committing to trusting that there may be a way of doing my work that is not so predictable, and that by letting go of expectations as an environmental attorney or as an executive director or staff person, but truly to be open to the possibility that there were so many things that I had yet to learn, and who did I want to learn with and from. Mm-hmm. And that for me brought some of the joy back into my work, and the sense of inclusion and the question.
It's interesting. And we were even, talking before we got on about this. It feels to me like it was such a moment where you got to choose to, do I continue trying to make a change from within this broken system? Mm-hmm. Or do I step outside of it and begin to create an old slash or amplify it, an old system?
Yes.
And bring back into alignment, like, what has been lost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that really goes back to the prophecy of the condor and the eagle, and the sense of balance that we are completely out of. And the sense of, is it really, the mind and the heart, what leads, and what is listened to, and what is considered knowledge. And so I started to listen more to my gut and to other forms of teachings that I thought would be so much more informative. And it broke open sort of the habits that we have and made space for learning from different people.
Exactly, like, who are our teachers? Mm-hmm. Is it these same bunch of people in suits up on their pedestal making policy, or is it the people on the ground who are actually living the reality of these forces of oppression, ultimately? Yeah.
Exactly, and other beings, other animal beings, other spirits, other ways, other knowledge systems. And also for me, it was about deep listening. So many times we all strive to convey a certain sense of familiarity with a topic, filling the space with words that are really on repeat, and the rhetoric has created a sense of disengagement with people whose hearts are truly available if we want to invite them to participate in something. But the rhetoric is so much static that stepping back and taking time to listen and invite other voices was for me the most valuable time. And it was a path and a change and a decision and a risk.
Mm. And what did you hear? I would love to just to tie this part up. What did you hear when you were on the ground at Standing Rock? I think that the time that it was, what was actually happening, it was such a moment for people to really feel empathy for what has happened here in the US and what continues to happen here in the US and what has not been addressed in terms of the oppression of Indigenous peoples here. I would love to hear from somebody who was on the ground at that moment in time. What did you hear? Perhaps, Erin, this is when you come in with your story.
Yeah. You know, when we were in Standing Rock, when I first got there, my little brother and sister, about a week earlier, I had told them that there was this thing happening and that these youth had run across the United States to raise awareness about a pipeline that they wanted and didn't want in their backyard. That they had run all the way to, you know, the White House to tell President Obama, who had been on their reservation, you know, 2 years prior and said, you know, I love you. I think of you like my children. Even after, you know, the two, you know, minimal hours that I spent with you, I just love these kids. And these kids thought, you know, we're going to go run and we're going to tell President Obama what happens. And because he loves us, he's going to make it stop. And they ran all the way there because they didn't know what else to do. They're poor. They don't have the support. They don't have, you know, I mean, they do have some support. I don't want to say that they don't. But they don't have, you know, the financial resources or the privileges that a lot of us do have. And they found a way, you know, just with their feet, and they ran. And then they came home realizing that no one was going to help them. And I told, you know, my little brother and sister, these kids that did this incredible thing, you know, they started a camp. And they're resisting this pipeline, and, you know, that's how cool is it that, you know, people are doing this thing. And my little brother and sister, we had lost all of our matriarchs, you know, in recent years. And so a lot of us were very, very depressed and, you know, sad. And our grandmothers, they were fighters, and they were strong women that stood up to all manner of men and, you know, injustice. And the next morning, I got a call from my aunt that said, I don't know what you said to them, but they packed up their car in the middle of the night and they drove to North Dakota from New Mexico, you know, across the country. And she said, it's your responsibility to go take care of them and figure out what had happened. And I can only convey to the people that haven't been there the sense of home. And I know that sounds cheesy to the people that were there. But, you know, for those of us that had been displaced, for those of us that had grown up in urban reservations, for those of us that had been taken from our families, you know, to come into a place and see, you just come around this corner and you see thousands of smokestacks and you see tents and teepees and hogans and wickiups and any sort of traditional housing, and you realize, like, this is what it would have been like if they had just left us alone, you know. And you get out of the car and you can feel the earth shaking, and it's not just the people walking, and it's not just everyone dancing their own dances or singing their songs or drumming their drums. It's really the medicine that pre-existed that camp where traditionally it had been a place of meeting and a place of peace. People would come down the Missouri River, the Cannonball River, and all these different nations would meet together, and they would be at a time of peace. Whatever war they were in, they would say, you know, here's where we're going to trade, we're going to plant our medicines, we're all going to take turns gathering these medicines, and we're going to be there. And you could feel the ancestry in the ground in that moment. And, you know, what did we hear in Standing Rock? I think the most resounding message was one of presence. And I think that is one thing that people really don't, aren't aware of, right, is the erasure of Indigenous peoples in this country, and having a moment, even for one brief moment, to have somebody look at us and actually see us as we were and realize that we weren't just these, you know, tearing savages, warpath, you know, Indians that were riding across the country and John Wayne was going to shoot us and win the day back for everybody. You know, we were lawyers and, you know, like Janet, and educators, and we were doctors, we were teachers, we were, you know, sex workers, we were youth, we were healers, we were addicts that were coming to be healed. We were all manner of people, every kind of person, and not just Indigenous, but people finding their way home again. And I think that for those that came to see the resilience of a people that has been so diligently dominated in this occupied country was really healing. And I think, you know, coming out of all of that at the end of it was, again, so much re-traumatization of Indigenous peoples and people of color that were there, Black folks that were there, but also a lot of inner tribal solidarity and ally and accompliship. And I think the biggest message, again, was just being seen.
Hmm. So please, can you tell me more about your involvement with Seeding Sovereignty, how you came to be involved, your background and what you bring and the work that you're doing with Seeding Sovereignty?
I don't want to say that I'm an activist. I think as an Indigenous person, we are born as stewards of the land. And so a lot of us step into these roles because it is just a continuation of what we've been doing in a more modern way, right? Even being on this podcast is kind of an act of decolonization, because here I am speaking to a white woman that has offered me space, right? Whereas before, I have always been trying to insert myself into that space. So I thank you for that. I am traditionally a youth worker. I grew up working with my grandmother, who was the first woman on our reservation to have her master's in education. She started the Hickory Apache Department of Education, and she is just this magnet in my head. And when I was a little girl, she used to tell me that you don't do for yourself until you learn how to do for others. And I think that has been one of the most clear messages of my life, is that, you know, growing up very poor but very loved kind of made me feel like anything that I had was always something that could be given back, as long as I had those core values. And so coming into Seeding Sovereignty, I had actually moved from the Southwest, where I'm from, to Standing Rock during the time of encampment. And after Standing Rock, I went to Minneapolis to work on Line 3, which is a pipeline that's currently being constructed in northern Minnesota through some of the most pristine wild rice beds in the world, at the headwaters of the Mississippi River. And so I went there to resist that pipeline because I spent a significant amount of time in Minnesota as a kid and really loved those waters, and went there to work for a while before meeting Janet, you know, online and over the phone, and realizing that there was this person who was doing intentional work for Indigenous women specifically, and making space with her resource and privilege to invite other sisters in. And it was a sort of healing that I needed at that time, I think, because for many people, as they know, nonprofit industry can be a really vexing kind of terrifying beast to think of, you know, all of the good, the facade of good that's happening, and some of the deeds that go on behind closed doors that aren't so great. And so coming out of a space that had been very traumatizing into Seeding Sovereignty was just kind of an act of almost desperation, and Janet throwing up the life raft and saying, you know, come on in. And since then, I think it's been my job is not only to help young folks reclaim their narratives, but also it's been a reclamation of my own, and coming into myself, because I really feel like hurt people in whatever manner that you hurt them. It could be through your words, it could be through your actions, it could be through your non-actions. And I think that I was a very hurting person who hurt people that were close to me because I had been re-traumatized because of the situation in Standing Rock. And since then, have been trying to help other people who are experiencing this continual systemic injustice to kind of work through their traumas in order to create a more fortified path for the youth that are going to be following in our footsteps.
So can you share some of the actual work that you're doing with people? Like, what you're talking about, this idea of hurt people, is something I hear quite often. And in the kind of wellness and healing spaces, that I think can almost become a shorthand for, well, I must heal myself before I can heal others. And I think there are two sides to that story, right, aren't there? So I'd love to hear a bit about, maybe we can expand on that later, but some of the work you're actually doing with people to help, like you say, individuals who have just, like, who are living with traumas that have been compacted and compressed and compounded over generations, and who are hurting so so deeply, to help people step back into their sovereignty, like, ultimately.
Yeah, I think the main focus of the work that it speaks directly to this subject is my program, which is called Storytellers. And essentially, we're working to give equipment, media equipment and tools, training to young queer youth, primarily Indigenous, trans, two-spirit youth, that are looking to tell their own stories. I think one of the biggest things that I've noticed, especially in this occupied land and other occupied countries, is that there's this dominating narrative of what exists and what's real and what is. And then there's the underlying, the undercurrent of what the reality is and what actually happened in all of these atrocities that were committed by, you know, insanely malicious people, and what's happening. And other folks, you know, throughout the years have been forced to swallow this same narrative, and it's almost like this brainwashing that's occurred. So with Storytellers, you know, we're giving the tools to these young folks to go to the front lines of whatever their front line may be. A lot of people see that as a, you know, a protest camp or, you know, a nonviolent direct action or something like that. But really, we're looking at how to queer the front lines of every kind of front line. I have, you know, young folks that are working on trans rights. I have other folks that are working, you know, as tiny house warriors fighting the Trans Mountain Pipeline. There are people that are working against border issues. We have young folks that are working, you know, in Minnesota, reclaiming their languages and their traditional dances. Other young folks that are working to, you know, stop the building of the border wall in Tohono-O'odham Nation. And, you know, every intersection that you can imagine, even, you know, my young friends that are learning how to become doulas and reclaiming Indigenous midwifing knowledge is really huge. And with Storytellers, we're having them make these short videos to essentially introduce Indigenous peoples as they are today, with stories that are being produced by the most underserved within our communities, these LGBTQIA plus youth who are shunned because of the patriarchy and the Christianization of our peoples.
Mm-hmm. And so what can you share with me about how, like, the actual process of healing from these kinds of traumas that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think, you know, having somebody to listen to you even just in this moment is a type of healing, right? Mm. Having somebody see you for the first time. So many of the youth that I work with think that they're invisible to the world. And they think that the only way anyone's ever going to see them is as a, you know, an R-word, or, you know, more commonly known as the Washington football team, the Redskins. And I don't like saying that word. But, you know, or being seen as a cartoon, or being seen as, you know, a Halloween costume, or whatever the case may be.
Or the stereotype, ultimately,
Or even insofar as looking at photographers now, like Aaron Huey, who have gone to the Oglala Lakota Nation for years and are photographing these sacred ceremonies and then capitalizing off of them and saying, well, I was just here to remind everyone that you're here. Well, our youth don't need anybody. We don't need anybody to tell our own story. In fact, that is the point of trauma, is that people continually think that our narratives are theirs to control. And essentially the healing comes in is being able to first look at a youth, you know, a young person, and say, I see you. And if you're fucked up, that's okay, because me too. And if you're sad, that's okay, because me too. And if you're joyous, tell me why you're joyous, because I want to reclaim that joy too. Even insofar as, you know, spending time with these youth on webinars and just saying, you know, what are you doing? What are you reading? This is what I'm reading. And, you know, I recently read Pleasure Activism by Adrienne Marie Brown, and talking to my little sisters about things as, you know, like masturbation, and saying, you know, this is a way, this is actual activism that you can reclaim, bringing joy back into a body that has been continually traumatized, knowing that the blood memory in your DNA remembers everything that happened to not only us, but to your mother, to your grandmother, to everyone down the line when, you know, expansion happened and when people arrived. And saying, you feel all of that, and that's okay, because I feel it too. Tell me how it makes you feel. And giving them the opportunity to say, this is my life in this moment. This is how I feel. This is the lens that I look through. And not me saying, this is how I want other people to see you, but this is how I see you and how you want to be seen, I think is the biggest point of healing. And also giving, you know, people, not just our Indigenous youth, but the other partners that we work with, giving them the platform to share stories that people don't want to hear. And, you know, people don't want to talk about man camps and the violence against women. People don't want to hear any more about the suicides within Indigenous communities. But they are a reality that we wake up to and go to bed with every single day. And having the ability to say things are messed up because you broke them first to the people that harmed us, I feel like is a way to reclaim our power, because when else do you get the opportunity to face down your colonizer, even in a broad sense, and say, no more, you can't extract from me. I'm taking back and giving back. Mm. You know, the reciprocity doesn't exist in a lot of places in the world, but within Ceding Sovereignty, it's our goal to ensure that we're not extracting stories from people, that we're just merely amplifying them.
Thank you so much for sharing this. You are such an amazing speaker. Like, wow, please.
I hope that you find many more platforms to speak on. You're so articulate, and the way you're explaining this and sharing this is just, it's beautiful. Thank you. I love the way you're speaking about activism as well as meaning many different things. It can mean encampments, and it can mean marches, and it can mean running to the White House, and it can mean placards, but it can also mean masturbation, and it can also mean like reclaiming language, and it can also mean sharing or creating spaces for empathy to flourish. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've spoken about before on The Numinous, this idea of spiritual activism. And I wonder if you could just share a little about how, for anyone listening, like how they might begin to start thinking of their activism outside of what the narrative we have about what it means to be an activist.
Yeah. You know, I think for anyone that's listening to that right now, I think the time is to look at how you can do everything that isn't like what we thought activism was, right?
Right. At 180, yeah.
No, I really love the energy of marches, and I really love the power of parades and all of these. I mean, I just did Pride in LA, and was just like, they had an Indigenous contingent for the first time ever.
Wow.
Which is, how do you do that, right? I just want to look at the whole world. Like, how do y'all go about your day every single day without realizing that you are standing on the bones of a genocide that was committed by people that got here before you? But I can't, right? I didn't drink my coffee and shut up. But I was at the Pride Parade and realized that they sandwiched the Indigenous peoples behind the obnoxious Disney display, behind Wells Fargo, in front of the 5 police departments and the FBI that they had marching. And we were kind of, people were taking our picture because we were dressed in regalia. And, you know, they were just, I felt kind of like a caricature of myself. And so while I appreciate, like I said, you know, the energy of those places, and I think the inherent intentions are good, I think that we are at a point where we can no longer just keep talking about things or wasting carbon to get to one place to show up to then find another way to waste more carbon. To just, I feel like all of us are just shouting at a void right now with these things. And I think that right now it's time for critical action. Whether that be you financially supporting campaigns that are on the ground, being that you're physically showing up as an ally and putting your body on the line so that people of color, Indigenous folks and Black folks don't have to do that and go to jail and be serving way more jail time. I mean, we think about people like Red Fawn. How is it that there were, you know, we were the 12th largest city in North Dakota for months in our encampment alone, which of course scared the shit out of North Dakota. And how is it that there was a woman there that went to jail now for going to be, you know, 5 more years at this point, because a man infiltrated our camp and worked for the FBI, and, you know, all these non-Native allies were there. How is it that Red Fawn is the one going to jail? How, you know, and I really want people to think critically. How is it that people of color are going to jail? How is it that we are the ones being incarcerated or imprisoned or isolated or avoided or, you know, whatever the case may be? How is it that it's happening to us, and why is it that it doesn't bother you more? I really think people need to think about not only activism, the activism of even the movements and supporting, anti-plastics campaigns and also campaigns for personal cleanup. You can be an activist with a bag on the beach, you know, picking up trash. My mom, that's one of the things I hated about her actually growing up, was that we couldn't go anywhere without her making us pick up trash. You know, there was no hike without coming out with a bag of trash, and, you know, being a brown family in Midwestern Minnesota, you know, walking around with a trash bag. They all thought that we were working because we were, you know, why else would brown people be out there with trash bags? And they would come up and, you know, give us their trash. And I remember as a child being so embarrassed, thinking, God, Mom, like, they think we're here because we did something wrong, not because we're people that can enjoy the outdoors. And they, it's our fucking land to begin with, you know, and that used to drive, I remember being a kid and just that driving me crazy. And I think that, you know, activism can be in the form of you knowing that there are people in your neighborhood that can't afford lunch for their children and going to the local school and paying their lunch for them. Mm. Activism can be realizing that there is a woman sitting at the end of your street on the ground and crying. Why is she crying? Asking her if she's okay. People think, I think a lot of the time, that activism looks like this big display, right? If you can't have a story on your Instagram, you know, showing that you've done it, then there's no real way that you've proven that you're an activist. And I really think that that's a falsified narrative. And I really think people need to get of the mind frame that you can do things that are good for the world without anybody seeing it, and that we survived millennia without cell phones to prove that we were good people.
Yeah.
And I really, even hosting a podcast, right, and giving somebody the opportunity to tell their story, that's a form of activism, because you come from people that wanted people like me dead. You know, your ancestors came to my lands and killed me, and then proceeded to tell everyone else that it was okay, and to keep killing, and just to change the way in which they killed us, right? So it wasn't, activism can be finding a way to provide you know, fresh fruits and vegetables to neighboring indigenous communities that don't have the access. If you're a grower, take a bushel of whatever you have to a neighboring community and give it back, because our people are dying. And it's not just because of issues like alcoholism and poverty. Mm-hmm. It's issues like having no access to good food, living in food deserts. And I think I would really impress upon people that you can be an activist simply by doing small things and taking those small actions, you know, over the course of a year. If you think about the man at the end of your street that you make sure has a bottle of water and a granola bar in the morning, you know, when you're walking to work, you know that you're contributing in some small way. If that's all you can do, that's okay.
And if everyone was contributing in those small ways, then we'd create massive change. I love what you're saying about the idea of, well, a lot of what you're talking about, these are simple acts of, small acts of caretaking, you know, and empathy and support, like human to human. And it's not about like these big displays of like, I'm taking a stand and I'm standing on this podium and now everyone look at me, I'm a good person because I did this, you know, that sort of idea. And this it being much more about this idea of like, yeah, repayment of, well, just in care, ultimately, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, Naira Wahid, she wrote, and I'm just going to paraphrase, she wrote this poem that said, you know, look at us, we look like the hate, our mother is weeping, we look like the hate that came to eat us. And I think about that a lot, is just the loss of humanity within our cultures, not just here in the United States, but all around the world, is that we have decided as a human culture that, you know, we deserve to be more than other people. We deserve to possess more than other people. We deserve, you know, it's not just classism, it's narcissism, right? Our voices matter more than other people. And it's not just, you know, racism, right? It's this inherent sense. And I really do think that we need to even have activists in the, you know, psychological fields and the sociological fields, where they're going in and they're saying, we are sick. As a group of people, it is not just black people, it is not just white people, it is not just native people, it is not just Latinx folks, like, it is all of us as a whole. We are all sick, and the activism needs to come in to play of, you know, how, like you said, how are we caretaking, but also how are we reclaiming our humanity? How is it that we can scroll past an Instagram story about 100 Sudanese people being wiped out for standing up to their government and then go post a selfie of us eating our ice cream? What in what world are we so broken that we can see these horrible things, be made aware of them, and keep living our lives? And I really think that part of the work that Seeding Sovereignty does is put these garish things in people's faces and say, look at it.
Feel it. Yeah.
And then do something about it, right? Yeah. Don't just share a post. take action in whatever way you can.
Yeah, the idea of kind of Instagram activism, it's like it's a great platform for sharing, and yet it's a platform that also perpetuates the idea that some of us are more valuable than others by the number of followers that we have, you know? And I'm often thinking about that, like how can we decolonize our thinking around hierarchical structures, you know, whilst also still living in this world that kind of operates by them, you know? Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts? I mean, yeah, your Instagram feed is impactful and powerful. And I'm wondering if you could share any other sort of ideas or just thoughts for people about how to really use social media as a platform for change.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that people should be doing with their Instagram is definitely taking a look at who they're following and taking account of what they're placing importance on. I don't want to like shame anybody, you know. Of course, I follow, you know, fashion bloggers that I like and you know, people that are creatives that I like and musicians, you know, a lot of them are my friends. And I follow those types of people as well. But I also follow people that say things that sometimes I don't like to hear. Right. Mm. I follow black trans femme women that are like, y'all are fucking up every day. Stop co-opting every single thing that we do. Stop saying that it was you and it's us. Like, you've been doing that forever. And as an Indigenous person, I always want to be like, well, it's my land, but I have to take in the account that, like, into account that my people can be anti-black, and that we have black folks in our Indigenous communities that are being erased, that are being unseen by our own people, and having to be critical with myself. I feel like everybody that's on social media needs to be very critical of how they're using it. And of course, you know, that platform was created as a, you know, a photo sharing platform, and it has evolved in this, you know, incredible way. But also, I think people need to realize that if they have those platforms, there needs to be some sort of reciprocity with other people. That if all you can do is social media activism, I don't want to degrade that. Mm. But I want to say that you need to be taking more action. If you do have the platform where you are visible, what sort of privilege do you have that you can afford to other people? Mm. If all it is just a made up space that's not intangible, right? That no one can ever you can't take with you when you die, no matter how many followers you have. You know, I really think like
I often think about what would happen if it all just went away tomorrow, and people who are investing their whole lives in building their follow account, like poof, it all just disappears. You know, where would we be then? How would we amplify? How would we use our voices then? Like, how then would we be spiritual activists? Or, you know, how would we then be?
Well, it's intentional, isn't it, to make an entire generation of people addicted to something that could be taken away at any moment, and you take away their sense of self and their way of knowing and their way of being. I feel like that's I don't want to get into, like, conspiracy theories here.
Oh, please do.
But, you know, I definitely feel like the government does many a thing to figure out how to mess with the psyche, you know, governments, plural, around the world, to mess with the psyche of their nations, occupied or not. And I really think that social media can be one of those things. I mean, you look at that blithering idiot that's in the White House right now, and you think about the fact that he has Andrew fucking Jackson hanging behind him, and every single day the Indian killer stares down at this man who is continuing his genocide against the people who've already suffered so much in this country through actions of supporting pipelines and extraction and offshore drilling and mining and fracking and whatever the fuck else, you know, I mean, damage against sex workers that he does. I mean, you think about it's an amalgamation of everything awful, and he uses Twitter as his platform to share those awful messages. And then you see the mass shootings that happen, and you see the you know, the terroristic plans, and you have all of these things, and you realize that it's being controlled by Twitter, and Twitter is saying he's not violating anything, right?
Freedom of speech.
It's freedom of speech, but it's an act of white supremacy. And I really feel like people need to start looking at Facebook and Instagram, right, which is Mark Zuckerberg, and thinking about how Mark Zuckerberg is a colonizer that has taken over islands in Hawaii and is forcing Native Hawaiians out. We need to think about his white supremacy and his patriarchy and how we are investing in that as users of his platforms.
And how our psyches are being colonized, like you say, yeah.
And same with Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I really don't care who the owner of Twitter is either, but, you know, whoever it is, they don't give a damn about us.
No.
And I think that people need to start thinking, like you said, of why aren't we investing in postal service anymore, right? When did sending a physical letter, something tangible, become so mundane to us that something we can no longer hold, hugs that we could no longer feel, compliments that no longer mattered really, you know, when did that become more important than actually physically holding the world that we're in and being a part of it? Mm. It really blows my mind, not just as an Indigenous person, but just a citizen of this world, looking at how much even since I was a child, the psyche of everyone around me has changed. And even looking at older generations now who are taking part in social media that have no idea how it's impacting even them. And you think about all these stressors that are put on people by social media, and then, you know, I'm too stressed to actually take action. You get bogged down so much by something so fake.
Exactly.
And I really feel like, yeah, we use our platform a lot, right? Because you're playing part of the game, but we're also infiltrating other systems in a very meaningful way and training other people how to infiltrate these systems of injustice so that we can hopefully, honestly, pull the chair out from underneath them and fuck it all up.
Yes. I love it. Can we speak specifically about how we can apply what you're talking about to the wellness space and the healing space? I kind of shared in the beginning that, you know, a big part of my mission with the Numinous when I first launched it 7 years ago was to make sort of more emotional, spiritual healing tools, which ultimately so many of them are about helping people to touch in with their own intuition, to begin to trust their own voice and their own experience over what the information that they're receiving from the outside world. And I'm talking about things like astrology and tarot, which have been kind of big practices of mine and are what I share a lot about with the Numinous. But how, in a way, I sort of see now that the simultaneously, like the, and I'm doing air quotes, and I always say that when I'm doing podcasts, this is an air quote moment, the kind of wellness space has blown up. Again, you described the sort of healing or wellness industry earlier, and when I hear that word industry, I'm like, okay, where industry leads, capitalism is not far behind, and there yet more damage and harm potentially. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little to, you mentioned before we got on that you host a podcast also, and I'd love for you to share people where they can listen to your podcast, but you speak to wellness leaders or healers about how they can really become more aware of maybe the unconscious ways that systems of oppression and marginalization and hierarchies are being perpetuated in a space that is supposed to be about healing and creating equity and bringing people back into a place of wholeness. And yeah, if you could just begin to speak a bit about that, that'd be super helpful.
I have this friend, their name is Loba, and they're this educator that lives in Los Angeles, and they're not from the United States, and they are one of the most fiery people I've ever met in my life, but they, you know, often talk about healing spaces and how damaging it is for Indigenous peoples. A lot of these sacred ceremonies, these cacao ceremonies, the ayahuasca, all of these different things, white people in particular, or non-native to the region where these ceremonies come from, have the privilege of getting to these remote regions, have the privilege of learning from these elders who displaced peoples, right, would probably love to learn from their own teachers, learn truths that are, you know, deeply rooted in their bone marrow, things that sit in the, you know, the most innermost dwellings of their heart, and they don't have access to it. And you think about how damaging that is to see someone who is performing a ceremony that you would desperately love to learn how to perform because that's your lineage, and not having access, and yet this other person has not only had the privilege of traveling to the place to learn about it from the person, you know, from the originator or somebody that's carried this ceremony for so long, but then been able to bring it back and capitalize off of it. I don't think people realize even something like sage, you know, and how endangered California white sage is and how endangered, you know, other types of sage are in this country. People, you know, in astrology spaces and healing and wellness spaces have discovered the power of smudging, I feel like everyone keeps like rediscovering things and rebranding things, and I want to be like, y'all should just hang out with natives like once in your lives and realize that your entire world will come crumbling down around you when you realize that everything about your, you know, your life has been stolen. How it must feel to be on the opposite end of the table and receiving that knowledge. Mm. That, you know, what you're doing is actually physically harming people. You learning how to smudge and not knowing where you got your sage from, not knowing how it was acquired, not knowing if tobacco was put down to thank the plant, not knowing if the roots of the plant were pulled out to give you that bundle. You don't know where it came from, and it came packaged to you in plastic. You know, and thinking about the extractive process of what led up to that plastic being wrapped around that extracted sage and then brought to your house where you're smudging the bad spirits out of your house, and the bad spirit may be you because you made the purchase. You know, that's a hard, hard thing to hear. And I understand that it's probably really hard for people to hear, but how it must feel to be again on the other end of that table as the indigenous person watching somebody else be able to do everything that you've wanted to do your whole life but can't. And I really think that part of the healing that needs to come into these wellness spaces and is an acknowledgement of the fact that a lot of these movements, these ways of knowing, have been co-opted from traditional healers. And a lot of people come back and say, well, the person gifted me this knowledge and I went through, you know, the ayahuasca ceremony and it was just super great and life-changing. And now I just want to tell everybody at my yoga studio about it and we should all do ayahuasca together. And it's, you know, like, fuck off, really. And I mean that to hurt, you know, I genuinely mean that to, for people listening, if that's happened to them or gone to a cacao ceremony or whatever it is that you think that you're worthy of doing, whether or not you think that you've been gifted that ceremony, you have not. Right? Because it's not up to that person. It's up to the ancestors. It's up to the people of the land. It's up to the land itself. Did you ask if you could have those cacao leaves? Did you ask if you could take that peyote? And not just from somebody, a friend of yours at Burning Man that told you it was a good idea if you could find the plant. You know, genuinely asking the people of the land, do you even know the territory that you're on where you're performing these ceremonies? You know, at the beginning of the podcast, they said, we're on Lenape Hoking. This is traditional Lenape territory. How many of you listening here in New York knew that that's where you were? How many of you knew that the World Trade Center was built by the Mohawk because white people were too scared to go that high and the men went up without harnesses? I mean, do you know the history of the land that you're on when you're performing these ceremonies, when you're hosting these wellness spaces? And are you really bringing healing or are you bringing more harm?
Mm. Thank you. And I think part of our collective process, and I'll speak on behalf of myself and listeners, is to be able to hold your hurt and to hear your hurt and to feel the impact of that, you know, and to really take into account, take responsibility for all that is unfolding in this space, you know, and to really think about healing on a collective level and on in terms of healing the land and of healing the wrongs that have been done. So thank you for sharing. And I just want to say to everybody listening, thank you for being here and listening to this as well and for showing up. You know, a lot of people have been reaching out to me since I started this podcast saying thank you for having some of these conversations that people don't really want to be having in the wellness space. And I'm like, this is where we're at. We can't ignore this. We can't just like pretend that, hey, it's all okay because I did X ceremony or I know this about my birth chart now, so I can just kind of, you know, forget about these things. So thank you so much.
Yeah, and I want to add too that it's not to say that I don't want people to learn how to heal themselves. And I feel that's the case for a lot of, and I'm just one person, right? I can't even speak on behalf of Jicarilla people or Laguna people, right? I'm just one person of those nations and a guest here on the Lenape territory. But I do think people deserve to heal. I do think that they deserve to find what rituals and ceremonies and reclamations of self work for them. I just want to be very abundantly clear that if you are practicing these ceremonies and if you are trying to be intentional, there's so much history that needs to be learned, and there's so many protocols that need to be gone through in order to obtain the permission in a good way, in the right way, you know, in, no matter what your intention is. If you're not going through the levels of permission and also education with your own self about what it is that you so value, then I think that you really will just continue to re-traumatize and perpetuate harm in these spaces. And I think that, you know, I would love to have a world of herbalists and yogis and healers and traditional medicine keepers and, you know, traditional wellness spaces. We had that in Standing Rock, and it was wonderful to walk into an apothecary and know that these medicines were sent from all over the world for you. I would love to have those spaces in every home community, but we cannot create them without acknowledgement of what happened in order for healing to be needed.
Mm.
You can't just bring healing and wellness in without knowing why healing and wellness is needed. And I feel like it's a little narcissistic of a lot of people to just enter it with this like healing or this wealth of wellness and saying, I brought all this for you. And it's, you know, thanks. But I got fucked up on my own from other reasons. And do you want to talk about that? No, I just want to give you this medicine that I got in Peru. That's not going to fix the systemic issue. And if people that are doing this have large followings, they're really encouraging the wrong type of behavior from people that are trying to so desperately help.
Mm.
And I just would invite people to kind of look through that lens of how is the work I'm doing not only intentional, but really going to be impacting the communities I want to be a part of.
I think that's it, isn't it? It's like we can so often think about, I have discovered I hurt. It hurts, right? It hurts to be me. And we can enter into a healing journey wanting to address what it is that hurts. But it's almost like the more layers that are peeled back, we get down to this original hurt of like this horrible histories that we share, right? Of oppression and violence and separation. So ultimately, what we're all healing from, I guess where I'm getting to in my own journey and just from speaking with all sorts of different people, is like the deep hurt here that we can no longer go on without addressing, like the deep, deep hurt, you know, mm-hmm. that deep wound of separation, of violence.
And grief is a part of healing, right?
Yeah.
And for many people that are grieving the world right now, they talk a lot about eco-anxiety and eco-grief. Mm-hmm. I think one of the ways to heal is by first, acknowledging the land. I really truly believe that if people saw the land as a peer and not as a servant, more of a giving tree of sorts, right? That's just this stump that we keep trying to hack at to take more from. I think people will really understand that the reciprocity and the real healing comes from nature itself, and that we needn't go to so many wellness spaces or mm-hmm. clinics or mm-hmm. emergent whatever
mm-hmm.
to try and find ourselves. If we really found a way to reconnect and protect our true home, you know, then we would find all the healing that we need. And I think people are just touching little aspects of healing. And I think that we could dive full in if we all just started talking and were more conscious of one another.
So much of what you're sharing just is making me think about how we live in this world and this society where we're always looking for the next quick fix. And that is so like a part of what's got us to where we're at, right? We don't want to take the time to really sit and listen and commune and feel and get educated. We want to like feel as better as we can, like as good as we can, as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just like, I feel like that's at the root of so much of what's wrong in the world, you know? And this idea of just kind of like taking our foot off the gas and actually just like being and feeling and like visiting nature, listening to each other, etc., is so healing in and of itself,
mm-hmm.
you know? So that's a little preface. Again, I'm taking a couple of months out from the newness after this to do exactly that, and invite anybody listening as well to just really question why you're filling your days with so much, why your healing schedule is filled with so many different appointments and modalities and practices, and what if the best thing you could do right now is nothing and just sit and feel and reflect on some of the things you've heard today, on some other things that might be bubbling under the surface that you're too busy to acknowledge. You know, we can't ignore the deeper, bigger conversations that are happening, and we definitely can't ignore the earth is speaking to us so loud and so clear. And if we would just stop and listen, that could be a good place to start a deeper healing from, I think is kind of what you're saying as well.
Yes. Yeah. I was just thinking about how, Tahlequah, I think she was like J-17, she was one of the southern residents, the orcas that pushed her baby on her nose through the ocean for, 19 days, I think it was, she carried her dead calf through the ocean. And everyone kept saying, how weird. you know, for a whale. We've never seen whales do that before, and how bizarre, you know, that they're acting so humane. And I was thinking at the time, you know, how is it that it's a clear display of a mother grieving, and it's a clear display of a cry for help, and she wanted everyone to see. She pushed that baby thousands of miles. Women, you know, I mean women, the females in her pod, you know, her sisters and her mothers and, you know, all of those pod members, they took turns, because she wasn't eating, took turns pushing the dead body through the ocean. And everyone posted about it on their Instagram, and they said, wow, this is just really a horrible thing. And then they booked their Carnival Cruise Liner tickets to go on a vacation for self-care without thinking about the fact that these things are moving through the water, releasing everything that they are destroying, that they're doing, you know, sonar bombing in, you know, Washington, the Navy is, and yet we're going to support the Navy because we support our troops. I mean, whatever facet mm-hmm. of the world you're looking through, I think that there are so many different ways to find healing and so many ways in which the Earth and its inhabitants are telling us that the path that we are on is the wrong one, and that we have the ability to turn it back. And, you know, people always say, oh, if I had a time machine, you actually do. And it's called Indigenous Knowledge and Wisdom. And you look at things, and how is it that we have been managing carbon, and how is it that we were setting intentional fires to manage our forests, and how is it that we were creating irrigation systems in places that they shouldn't have existed, right? And all of these different things. And we had all these ways of knowing that protected this environment for everyone now. And you think about how the majority of the protected places on the earth are, you know, indigenous spaces. You think about forests and, you know, waterways and, you know, even the Amazon. There are so many nations there that have been uncontacted that are now giving still their lives to protect their forests, because they know, even in a place of, you know, complete remote location, they are aware that there is a greater cataclysmic event that's happening around them without the forest. And only, I really feel like, indigenous knowledge holders are aware of these, like, greater global impacts and how to kind of stop the clock with them. And it really, I think, you know, a lot of our answers are just looking at this indigenous wisdom and how we can kind of amplify those that have it mm-hmm. versus amplifying are solutions that are getting us nowhere, right?
Solutions that are kind of just tied up in so much policy and so much kind of, which are ultimately trying to protect mm-hmm. the capitalist system that exists, you know, ultimately.
Yeah. I don't know. I just really feel as though there are ways for people to be taking action at home, and they are so small and they may seem so minute to so many people, but if you are taking no action, right, anything small is contributing more than you had been before.
Yeah.
And I really think that I would just encourage anybody that's listening to really evaluate their lives, really evaluate what they think is equity in their lives, what they think is reciprocity, what they think is wellness, how they think that healing is actually healing, and how to actually bring a little truth into their space, because I feel like often you have to break something in order to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we are in varying systems of brokenness.
Mm.
And I feel like the only way we're going to piece ourselves back together is if we gather all the pieces together again and realize what it is that brought us to this moment, because it wasn't just colonization, and it wasn't just one bad decision by one corporation or one accident in the middle of an ocean or one war that put us on this path. It was cumulative decisions of millions of billions of people that are continuing to act in the way that they want to because they feel like their way is best.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to realize, mm-hmm. I think, in some sort of self-reflection, that our way may not always be best, but that we can learn how to be better.
Mm-hmm. When are you going to write a book? Can I help you write a book?
Yeah, please.
Like, I'm so serious. I'm going to say that on record, because that's more of the kind of work I want to move into, actually.
Yeah.
Just to put it out there as helping people tell their stories in that way too. But this is so important. There was a quote I posted on Instagram not so long ago, and it was like, you know, we blame society, but we are society. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of thing, isn't it? It's like each and every one of us is equally responsible for where we are at.
Mm.
And so each and every action that we take can be something that's contributing to the change that's needed. We just have to make that choice, right? And we just have to step up, say, okay, I've healed some of my personal stuff
And that means I now have the strength and the energy to be able to look out and begin to act. Because I think we hear so often, you know, this idea of like, heal yourself to heal the world. Mm-hmm. The self-healing piece is essential and is not where it ends, right? There is the actual kind of like, okay, so a lot of us are kind of like, we're on this healing path. We've been looking at some of our old personal stuff, and now is the time to think about, well, how am I actually enacting this in the world? Yeah. Particularly, again, and I'll bring it back to, you know, 2020 is going to be a huge year. It's a big year, astrologically speaking, in terms of the cycles that we're collectively moving through. And I'll be sharing more about that on the site when I come back in the fall. but yeah, really, I would love if maybe we could just kind of wrap up with some more sort of ways that people can begin to learn from and listen to and honor respectfully and get educated about some of the indigenous practices that perhaps we can begin to raise up, to amplify, to engage with in ways that are respectful and that are not unintentionally causing or perpetuating harm.
You know, I think one of the first ways to stop perpetuating harm, and one of the easiest ways, is to figure out whose territory you're on and to start speaking the name of the territory that you're in, right? The name of the people there. You're already calling in the spirits of bones and ancestors that do exist, and you're already bringing them to the table, right? And I think a lot of people keep thinking, well, if I just, you know, add a seat and put a person of color there, a queer person or a healer or an herbalist or something, you know, at the table, then I'll have everybody's opinion and it'll be enough to make sure that the conversation is conducive enough to be shared. And I really think that, you know, one of the ways in which people can start to take action is by educating themselves and not asking Indigenous people, people of color, Black folks, to do the education for them. I think that labor is labor is labor, no matter what form it takes. You know, emotional, physical, mental labor. All of this is labor. It's work, and continually, as a an Indigenous person, having to dive into, this is why you're hurting me, and this is what happened to me, to then prove that it's worthy enough for other people to start doing work on, is exhausting. And I know that that's the case for a lot of the, you know, the people that I learn from, is that they're just tired. Mm-hmm. They're tired of saying the same thing all the time. And I really think, you know, there's this incredible app, and it's also online, native-land.ca. It was created by a non-Native person, actually, who spent years doing research about the territories, the languages, the peoples of the land, and you can actually type in where you are into the search bar and learn about the languages that were spoken where you are, learn about the traditional names of the people that were there, and I think that's a really good place to start. I also think that, you know, there's a need for people to actually connect with communities that are not their communities. And I mean that really intentionally. If you're, you know, here in New York, there's probably not like this gigantic Native American association that you can go into and say, you know, I'm here and I want to be a part of it. You know, I think that would probably look a lot weird to the Native people. But to step into spaces and say, I'm here as an ally and this is my skill set, this is what I have to offer. Do you have any use of what I have to offer? Even if you're a graphic designer, even if you're somebody that is, you know, a youth worker and you can watch kids while a meeting is being had, even if you are an artist and you know how to host an art build and you can help make signs or, you know, creative resistance art, whatever your skill set is, making that offer to the people of the land, or to, if there's no, you know, Native people, obviously, to your, you know, your Black communities, to your communities of color, I think is really essential. And for people that are a part of those communities, you know, how can you give back? I think giving back to your community can look like self-care for yourself. I think that, you know, a lot of people feel like they have to go, 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 go. And if they're not going, then they're not doing. And if they're not doing, then they're worthless. And that's really part of like the capitalist production mindset here, you know, and in most Western mind frames, is that we have to be producing to be of worth. And I think that, you know, for people of color, Indigenous people, Black folks, you know, I speak for myself in this, is saying that me taking the time to speak on a podcast is an act of healing for myself, right? Is a way to say that my voice does matter, and that somebody else, you know, saying they want to hear me speak isn't, you know, what gives me power. What gives me power is knowing that my voice still works and that I can still bring attention to the things that need attending. And I think that, you know, people can really also look at their young folks in their communities and how are you giving back to the generations that are going to inherit this earth? Because ultimately we will be long gone before all of the really horrible things begin to happen. And how are we leaving this earth for people? I think there's a lot of just, I would most recommend self-reflection and kind of taking account of where you are in your life and what it is that you're doing to be a reciprocal human and how you're reclaiming your humanity, I think is one of the most necessary things that a person can be doing right now. And also evaluating, you know, your privileges. If you have social privilege, right, through your Instagram or whatever, if you have financial privileges, if you have transportation privileges, if you have, you know, food privileges, do you cook a large meal and you always have a ton of leftovers and your family never eats it? Why? You know, why?
And where does that food go?
Yeah, where does that food go? Why are we wasting? Who can you feed? Even, you know, one of the big things is in my way of knowing is that we have... every meal we have, we make a spirit plate or a spirit bowl, and you take a little bit of everything that you eat and you give it back to the ancestors because they're always here with us and they're always hungry. Everything that we long for, they long for too. And even spiritually giving back and the reciprocity that comes, I mean, that can be healing in of itself, right? Having a dream or, you know, even those that are lucid dreamers, talking to people, talking to whoever you can connect to, or dreaming and using the power of your dreams to do more is a way to give back. And I think that people really look at activism as this kind of buzzwordy, especially after Standing Rock, you know, and I'm sure there are people listening now that are like, shut up, Erin. But I really think that people started seeing it through one lens, through this very tactical, physical, only can be at a march, only can be in a pussy hat, only can be in front of the White House, only can be if we're, you know, locking down to something. And really, that is a glorious way of taking action, but it is not the only way. And if in a wellness space, in a healing space, what you can do is the education to say, hey, we're actually hosting yoga class in this territory. These were the people that were here. I learned this practice of yoga from this nation. They were the ones, and you can bring that to the table. That's already healing a brokenness that has existed in your community that you may not have even been aware of.
Yeah, very likely one. So thank you so much again for like bringing the light of awareness to these hugely important subjects. I really, really value you spending the time here today and all of the work that you've done to educate yourself to this level and to be in a position to be able to share in this way. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you to Janet. Janet's been here listening and holding the space for us both to have this conversation. So thank you, Janet, for taking that seed, for planting it and tending to it and saying yes to your calling.
Thank you.
I'm going to leave it here for now. I will do a little outro as a separate goodbye from me, not forever, for a couple of months. And again, thank you to Seeding Sovereignty. Oh, actually, one more thing that I do want to say. I would love to know how, if there are ways that my listeners can help you guys in your mission. I know, Janet, when we first met and you were just talking, Erin, about how resources don't have to just mean financial donations. They can, which is great. And I'm sure if people want to donate financially, that would be helpful for you. But also, you know, in terms of people bringing their skills, bringing hours that they might have to volunteer, like how can people get involved and help with Seeding Sovereignty in your mission?
You know, right now we are, thank you for that question, actually, that's very helpful for
yeah.
us. We are in a period of exponential growth right now, and there are, believe it or not, just three of us that do this work as a core. All of the time we have other folks that come in to help us temporarily, but we are looking for a web designer, somebody that can offer space to help us design a new website because we have outgrown the one that we've been using. We are also looking for people to you know, that have networks to help us develop our Pipeline to Plastics campaign, we really do want to expand on what sort of extractive industries are doing and how that's manifesting itself in our oceans in particular. Also looking at people, if anyone has support or would be willing to offer support, we have Indigenous youth, five queer youth that we are trying to provide summer internships for. This summer, we're looking for equipment, media equipment, cameras, booms, mics, things of the like that we are trying to raise so that we can give the youth the power to tell their own stories, as I shared earlier. And then also anybody that has any sort of nonviolent direct action training, drone training capabilities, editing capabilities, if you would even be willing to sit on a webinar with our team or our youth, I think that would be really helpful, as we have a lot of collective resources, but we are always willing to learn more. And I think that any sort of knowledge that anyone has that they'd be willing to share that would help us further this message of narrative reclamation, Indigenous futurism, as my friend Jade likes to say, you know, would really, really be so appreciated. We're trying to bring Indigenous peoples back into 2019, right? Mm-hmm. We're trying to remind people that we're not just the Redskins. We're not just, you know, these stupid, what does Trump call Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas, right? We're not just these nicknames that people have gotten familiar with. We're actually 573 federally recognized tribes, and all of the non-recognized tribes and the people that live above and below the medicine lines, right, in so-called Canada and so-called Mexico, and, you know, all of these people that are really still very here and still very worthy of attention and support and knowledge, especially being that we ensured that everybody else lived when they came here first, so... Thanks for that.
So there you have it. I'm going to share all the details wide and far so that you can reach out, get in touch with Seeding Sovereignty, and let them know what you have to offer. Thank you all again for being here. Goodbye for now. Thank you so, so much for being here to have this very important conversation with Janet and Aaron from Seeding Sovereignty. And thank you to Janet and Aaron for sharing their stories and for sharing their work here with us. I'm so grateful to all of you for showing up and listening to this podcast and helping give me the platform that means I can help to amplify stories like these, which are so, so important for us to take on board and to really listen to and pay attention to. Anybody who is invested in their own healing is by default invested or stepping up to play a part in the healing of some of the deeper-seated pains and traumas of the world that have been inflicted on Indigenous peoples in particular. This is actually the last episode of this season of The Now Age. I'm going to be taking a break from social media, and there's going to be plenty of messaging about why I'm doing that. And it touches on some of the It's to do with some of the issues that Aaron touched on in this episode. But it feels, like I said at the beginning of the episode, so, so unbelievably fitting that this is all going out coincidentally on July 4th, which here in the US, Independence Day is a holiday that ultimately celebrates the genocide of Native American peoples. And it feels very fitting that for my last episode of this season, which really has been... This podcast as a whole has really been a reflection of how where the numinous has grown to as I have evolved as an individual, as I have moved through my own healing process over the past 7 years in creating this content and managing and running this platform. I've really come to a place where I'm kind of like, I'm very aware that many of the practices and tools that I've shared have helped me so much. I'm in a pretty good place, and that now the time has really come to extend that wellness, extend that true sense of wellness and wholeness out to other people in the world and to other areas where it is needed. So I'm going to be focusing a little more on that this summer. And I invite you all to do the same. Like I said, I'm going to be taking a social media break. I'm going to be taking a break from the podcast. I'm going to be taking a break from my newsletter to really kind of recalibrate and sink deeply into my intuitive sense, my intuitive knowing of what is next for this platform, the Numinous. That said, look out for more messaging around the break. If you're listening to this podcast way in the future, come check out where we're at with the Numinous. Who knows how this platform will grow and evolve, but it will undoubtedly involve more of the kind of spiritual activism that we also discussed in this episode. Thank you all again for being here. I've loved creating these podcasts, and I'm excited to return when I am refreshed and ready to serve you all again. Thank you. This podcast features original music and is edited by aloaudio.com. aloeaudio.com.